Welcome to the Ritual House Podcast, a show about the rituals we practice, the new ones we create, and the many ways rituals help us live deeper, more meaningful, and more connected lives. I'm your host, Tova Leibovic Douglas, and allow me to be the first one to say, welcome home. Welcome back to the Ritual House. I'm Tova. For those that are new, so glad to welcome you. Those that have been here for a minute, so glad to have you. I want to talk a little bit about the episode today, which I think is awesome. My guest is my dear friend Iggy, who is a rabbi, spiritual counselor, thinker, dear friend, challenger of mine. I didn't say this in our conversation, but he challenges me in a good way. And I think we need people in our lives, right, by the way, that are like that, that are not only friends that say, yay, you're amazing, like, but the friends that say, is that really what you mean? You know, I think it's really important to surround ourselves with people that do that for us and for us to be open enough to receive that critique, and we can critique back. That is, like, in fact, I think exactly how we ought to be living. We talk a lot about Talmud today as a spiritual practice. You'll hear from him and how it is his spiritual practice and really a ritual for him. I wanted to just go into Talmud a little bit generally from my own perspective. I touch on this in our conversation, but I've been thinking a lot about it, how Talmud has influenced my life. And I'm going to define Talmud for all of you. Talmud literally means teaching. It's like literally to teach teaching. And it is the central text for Judaism. You could say rabbinic Judaism. Within Talmud, we have conversations from our rabbis in a really, it's like a non-linear form. It's an open conversation over generations. Generations of thinkers, of sages, that are really asking questions in regards to, yes, halakha, which is like Jewish law, but also bigger questions related to theology, to God, is God around, related to how to live a life of meaning. What does it mean to live a life of meaning? How do you do it Jewishly? How do you do it just as a human? When I first learned Talmud, it was in elementary school. I think it was in fifth grade. We saw a daf, a page of Talmud, and I was amazed at how it looked. The Aramaic and the Hebrew together, the letters all sort of looking like they blended together, but they meant something else. And I just thought to myself, I hope one day I can like really learn whatever this is, because we were just like learning it to just be like, this is what Talmud is, but we weren't really learning and studying it. I didn't really study Talmud until I was in college. And I have this relationship with Talmud that is actually really beautiful, because it kind of like represents my relationship with Judaism, which is, it's like I come in and like I want to be in there, and then I get close and I'm like, wait, do I belong here? Is it mine? And I always stay kind of close to it. I always study Talmud, but I don't insert myself in it. Or I do. I try to insert myself, and then I feel like I'm rejected in some way. What I'm taking from this conversation, that I hope you do too, is how amazing it is to have a spiritual practice that is a ritual that is steeped in something that is very deep and ancient, but applicable to oneself today. Meaning that we have this like through line to our ancestors, and Iggy really lives that and is that. And I think that that's really profound. I'm taking with me that sometimes resistance is there to actually teach us not to walk away, but to actually step in more. And that perhaps engaging with the things that are harder for us is precisely what we are meant to do in this time and formation of deconstruction and reconstruction of what it means to be Jewish today, what it means to be spiritual today, what it means to be religious today. And that I want to ask more of us to do that. One thing I would like to note about this episode is we do a lot of inside baseball, meaning the two of us just sort of talk the way that we talk. And there was this piece of me that wanted to pause us during our conversation and be like, wait, let's define who that person is. Let's define that word. Because I do want everyone to feel included in what we're talking about. And I didn't. And the thing is I actually think there's some merit to this process of me having a conversation with someone that is like just real in the way that we talk. And so I'm testing that out. And let me know if that was like frustrating for you. You could DM me, but also just pause and look the word up, and you don't need to know everything. That's okay. I think it's a really authentic conversation, and that's why I wanted to keep it as is. Really excited for you to just get to know Iggy and his wisdom. Here we go. All right. I am really excited to introduce our guest today. He is amazing. Okay. Everyone, this is Rabbi Igael Gurin Malu, a renowned Talmud teacher, spiritual counselor, and lecturer. He is sought after as a speaker and writer on subjects ranging from the Talmud, Jewish texts, spirituality, addiction, recovery, fatherhood, and LGBTQI plus issues. Through the use of ancient texts combined with practical spirituality, he offers models of healing that look at individuals' actions, beliefs, and values. His aim in providing spiritual counseling is to guide individuals in developing a life of meaning, joy, and purpose powered by spiritual practices and Talmudic wisdom. Rabbi Iggy serves on the board and faculty of the Academy Jewish Religion of California, AJR, California. Previously, he was the CEO and founder of Tshuva Center in New York and the director of spiritual counseling at Beit Tshuva in Los Angeles. Welcome, Iggy. I am so thrilled to have you. I want to share with our guests that Iggy for sure has this like beautiful, beautiful resume. And there's so much more to his resume that's not on the resume. I'll just say it's just like a short, it's like a little excerpt of what he's done in his life. I will say that Iggy is one of the fewer people I know in this world that truly walks with spiritual integrity. I really mean it. Like it's not just as a rabbi. Yes, he's a rabbi. Yes, he's a spiritual counselor. Yes, he like helps many people on a daily basis. But regardless of what he chooses to do with his life professionally, he is walking the walk of spiritual integrity and asking the questions, how can I live into who I am and what matters to the world for me? He's really taught me as a friend, but we met at Beit Tshuva when I was learning how to become a spiritual counselor, and he was a guide there for me. So he's been like a real teacher of mine on like how to do this spiritual integrity and like really walk your walk. He pushes the envelope for someone like me in real ways. And I'm so grateful for those early years of learning from you, but I'm even more grateful for our friendship because you do it every day of our friendship. So I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. That's very sweet.
Glad you're in the world.
Very kind. Thank you. I appreciate that very much. I do.
It's really true.
Thank you. My grandfather used to say, right, in Yiddish, is schwer sein a Yid, right? It's like it's hard being a Jew. Mostly because, well, you know, the Holocaust, but also he was a survivor, but also because, right, we keep, he says in Judaism, right, one of the things he taught me is we keep asking questions all the time, right? We keep sort of, if you want to walk with integrity, no matter what, spiritual integrity, whatever integrity, you have to constantly ask questions, right? And one of the things I love about Judaism is sort of like, right, there's constant, like, right, which bracha, which thing, what do I say on this? What do I say on that? How do I pray? When do I wake up? Like, right, which prayer, do you say tachanun or not say tachanun? Like, right, there's these constant things, right? And you're like, enough, can I just tell me what to do? And they're like, no.
Just do the thing.
Right, when I was in yeshiva, right, I grew up in a ultra-Orthodox sort of environment when I was in yeshiva, right, and you come to the Rav with a question like, what do I do with this thing? And right, and the Rav would be like, let's study. And I'm like, I don't want to study. Can I just get an answer? Just tell me what to do. I'll do it. Just tell me what to do. Which in that sense, and as you say that, right, you know, Benjamin Franklin sort of like invented this, and it's in one of the journaling sheets that I created a while ago, but it's sort of like the first part.
In one of the what sheets you created?
Journaling sheet.
Oh, yeah, journaling sheets, journal yeah.
Because I think if you want to change your life, that's a really easy way to start doing it in 3 weeks. One of the questions there is, when you wake up is, what good shall I do today?
Hmm.
Right? You have to ask yourself questions all the time.
All the time. Exhausting. It's exhausting to be Jewish. But I actually think it's interesting. I'm curious your thoughts on this. Like, I actually think that we're losing a little bit of that in Judaism, right? That like essential component of like Jewish asking of questions, not always having the answer or having 10 different answers to the question. that joke, right? Like one question and whatever. I don't know. Do we have that still in like modern day Jewish life, in your opinion? Is that still like alive?
I think for people who want a life of meaning, it's alive. I think for rabbis worth their weight in salt, I guess, waiting or whatever, hold water. You know, I'm notorious for like completely destroying idioms and sort of.
I just did it. I was like, I think it's like like one question. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Opinions. There's like some. There's some. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think yes. I think spiritual leaders, educators who really are devoted to helping themselves and others around this, do still do it.
Hmm.
I think one of the, and you know, we say this in jokingly, which it is exhausting, but I think one of the things that people face these days, and I get it, is that the exhaustions of modern life anyway. So like, oh, at least can my religion just give me some answers, right?
Right.
Because they come to people like you and me because they want answers, right? They want a leader, they want answers, right? My handle in Instagram, right, is sort of like, is not your rabbi, right? And yes, it's sort of tongue in cheek, of course, but I think for me, part of that is this important element of seek out the answers.
Always. It's like the only way to live. I mean, for you and I, right. I mean, that's like what I we think, do, yeah, but,
it's the ultimate way to live for anybody, but it is in fact difficult and it is in fact exhausting and it is in fact requiring you engagement. And some people might say, in this part of my life, I'm just too tired to engage. And I get that.
I do get that too. There's like 100 toothpaste bottles on the toothpaste aisle. Like I went to the pharmacy the other day actually, because I don't actually do that very often, but I went because I was like, oh, I need a couple things. And I was like, which toothpaste? Let me overanalyze the ingredients. And then I'm like, Tova, save that for all the other things, not for the toothpaste. Just choose the toothpaste. But it is, can be paralyzing.
It is, right? Analysis paralysis. It reminds me, you know, if people Google my name, one of the things come up is this piece that I wrote many, many years ago when my daughter, and I'm sure at some point she'll be mortified by this, when my daughter, right, got her first period. It's called With or Without Wings.
I remember that.
It's a comedy thing. Because, right, I was living in LA at the time. My partner was away, right? Sort of like, he's a guy, I'm a guy. We have a son who's older, right? She's my first, like, well, this is Saturday night, it's late, and she gets her period. And people should read it. But, like, right, eventually I go to sort of the, whatever, the Walgreens there, and I sort of like, and I look at the aisle of like, sort of feminine products, and I'm like, I don't know. Like, what, right? What size, what kind, with or without wings, right? Which brand? Do I want scented? Do I want not scented? Do I want this foam core, that foam core? Like, right? Like,
heavy, exactly, heavy, not light. Heavy. Like, now you have the organic on top
of it. And I'm like, right at the time, I was like, you know, granted, perhaps I should be more informed about this. Fair enough. Mea culpa again. But sort of like, I don't know, how many times do you change it? Like once an hour, every 10 minutes? Like what, you know? It's really thing. One of the pieces that's not in the piece, which is sort of, and I'm hoping it will make you laugh because that's the intention of it. But like, but right, some of those the pads have like a sticky side, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm glad you've learned this over the years. This
right,
is good.
But yeah. This is where I really embarrass myself. So as a guy, right, as a cisgendered guy, right,
totally.
If something bleeds. And there's a thing that has sticky things. The sticky part goes on the skin.
I see exactly where you're going on that.
And my daughter, right, because I'm outside of the bathroom, and then I say, like, you know, but use it like, you know, use it like a Band-Aid. She's like, I don't think that's gonna work. Like, really? Because, you know, that will hurt, right? Like, and I was like, okay. Right, like, so my point being, they are sort of the sort of like things, but when I went to the Walgreens, I bought all of them. I was like, I didn't know,
right?
So I bought like 16 kinds, right?
Yeah.
And also almost expecting, like, you know, her to be like, yeah, this is the one. It's like, she's 11, how do, like,
God.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel for her.
We've matured since then, and you know, and I have, you know, plenty of women in my life that sort of I called later or whatever. Although in that moment, I felt like this is a crisis I needed to solve. But yeah, but you know, I think that the choice that we have in general in life may seem to a lot of people as the ultimate, right? Also, right, people that so we work with, when they want to have choice, I want to have enough money to choose where I live and the car I want to drive and the clothes I wear. And one of the interesting things about this is I think that it's false.
Totally.
It's false. And when you commit to something, that is actual freedom. Having too many choices is, in my opinion, the opposite of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. I think our tradition sort of knows that, with Passover being the liberation tale and being the like ultimate, like
right.
We have like nothing to eat on that holiday,
right.
That, that's you right. know. And you also grew up with limited choices,
yes.
right? You grew up from
religious,
ultra-Orthodox,
right,
Haredi, would you label?
No, it's what funny because it? At the time that wasn't called Haredi, right? So like right,
yeah,
40,
exactly.
30, 40 years ago, there was like religious and non-religious. I mean, there was like,
right.
Are you Litvak? Are you Satmar? Are you Hasidic? Like, right? Yes, but it was much more binary than now, sort of, right? There's sort of, there wasn't this sort of this spectrum of Orthodox, modern Orthodox, conservative. It's like, I was like, I don't know where, like, you know, there was just, you're religious or not.
Yeah. Yeah. So you grew up though with not all the choices in the world.
No.
In fact, actually,
no.
Like
very few choices. There was sort of the things that we did and the things that we didn't do. And that was that.
Do you miss that kind of living?
Sometimes. Yeah. Right. It's, look, I often talk about in spiritual counseling about decision fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm a big believer in decision fatigue, right? The sort of that...
That it's good or it's not
that
good.
That we all have it and there's that you need to be able to sort of combat it. So like one of the reasons, I only wear black, right? I have the same t-shirt 14 times. I have the same sweater 14 times. I have the same jacket 14 times. Right? Like, so like...
It's because you want to be like Barack Obama. I'm just kidding. But right, anyone that is like at a high...
Look at me
right,
and be like, oh yeah, Mr. Obama. But not just Barack Obama. Barack Obama, Lia Yokoka.
No, it's just...
Yeah.
Right? Anyone
jobs,
at a high
like,
level does
any
that.
Any high level creatives and successful people will tell you very similar things, right? They'll have the same Benjamin Franklin. They wake up the same time. They go to bed the same time. They eat the same thing. They get dressed the same. They have the uniform. And the reason is decision fatigue, right? This sort of, for people who don't know, right? At the morning, when you wake up, you've got 100% decision-making power. Every decision you make, every single one, from snoozing how many times to what I'm going to wear to what I'm going to eat to where I'm going to go,
right,
chips away at that.
Yeah.
If you are a creative or people who make decisions, you need to preserve as many of those decision-making powers as possible.
Right.
Which is also for the regular person, right? If you come home after a long day of work of decision making and right, and your friend, roommate, partner, whatever says, what do you want to eat? And that feels like whatever you put on, like, I don't care. Like, right, that feeling of I don't care, that's decision fatigue. You really
right,
in that moment
sure.
can't make any choices anymore.
Yeah, talk to any parent that's
right.
like, especially during the pandemic and post-pandemic, like languishing that we're all, you know, like, or any person really that's taking care of people, right? But it's like this element of like, I've had to like really make so many different decisions. I can't
that's
make
right.
any.
That's
yeah.
Right.
It's really very challenging. And I've thought, by the way, about the wardrobe thing a lot because I've read a lot about it. I've thought a lot about it. And I'm like, I can't just wear black. I can't just wear gray. I don't have a color. Like there's some of us that
right.
are like, you know, multi.
So, you know, I'll say this, right? Because I have clients like that who'll be like, but I like fashion and I like, so do I, but like, I like, you know, I like color. And they're like, okay, so the way to do it, right? And people they say to me, you're not going to like it. But the way to do it is then you have to decide what you're going to wear the next day, the day before.
For sure. I do that.
Right? You have to lay it out.
That's the only
right?
way.
You have to
only
lay it
way.
Out and things. Because if you during that day, you've left money on the table. You've done something that you could have done better.
100%. It's like a big game changer. I love that we're talking about. I told Iggy before we started that I'm like organizing my house right now, spring cleaning, and like I'm in the weeds of my lack of organizational systems that like I need to like reevaluate. So like my brain is really there, but you know, I avoid this, but it really is a spiritual practice,
yeah.
right? Like it is like deep, I think, and I know you do too, like it is deeply for the well-being of like the whole person and the soul, really. Like it's the last on the list for me personally in my brain. Like I'm last on the list. It doesn't really matter, but it matters so much.
So and I'll say one more thing about this. And this is especially for people who think like, oh, this is for people who want to be successful or whatever. But when you are able to sort of to lean into understanding decision fatigue, it also helps you with the food choices you make at late at night. It makes it helps you with choices around your sobriety, right? Because if you have no more decision-making power and your friend says, let's go out to drink, you'll say yes, because like you just have no ability to say no. And in that sense, if you come home and you're like, oh, do I need to like stop by somewhere and cook something? You won't be able to say no. Decision-making power that you've relinquished will harm you.
Right. So interesting how everything builds on itself, right? Like how these things that feel very innocuous, like they're very small and like almost trivial, they end up actually like really building onto creating like patterning and systems that are like really hard for the soul. It's very frustrating. Okay, going back to you as a child, not having decision fatigue yet because everything was decided for you in that moment, but really your childhood in general, forgetting about that. Do you have a ritual that you remember, that you recall, that was like a container for you, that like really held you in some way, that you'd like to share with people?
So one of the things that sort of God or universe, whatever, has given me is an ability to remember things and analyze things. And because of that, as a kid, I was very good in Talmud, right? The Talmud, the sort of, right, the compendium, the codex that sort of has invented or reinvented Judaism as a rabbinical Judaism, has been able to give us survival and thriving sort of like skills throughout the ages, right? Is a large sort of, you know, collection of stories and laws and ideas and values and rights, about, you know, 2,711 pages and so. And there is one way of learning it, which is sort of what's called a Daf Yomi, which is, right, a page a day. So two sides of the page, a folio a day.
And to be clear, Daf Yomi is like a global spiritual practice.
Correct.
Like the whole world, there's people all over the world doing Daf Yomi every single day. Religious, not religious.
Correct.
Yes. But this is Iggy with a black
hat. Yes.
I'm picturing it. Go ahead.
And I was very good at studying Talmud, because again, there are two ways of studying. There's this sort of Daf Yomi, and there's also what's called Be'iyun, which is sort of like, right, so like deepening learning, which is what you do at yeshiva, right? There's these sort of like stories and sugyot, there's places that you study specifically more intently. But the general learning of Talmud is sort of this sort of like, right, it takes about 6.5 years and so forth and so on. I've been studying Talmud every single day since I was 5 years old. I have not missed,
wow,
as far as I can remember, a day of doing this. For those people who are my age and up maybe even, right? When I was like serving or other things, right? There used to be, I don't know if there still is, but there used to be a telephone number where you would call in if you didn't have the masecha with you, the page with you, whatever, and you didn't want to miss it. There was a telephone number that you would call, and somebody on the phone would actually recite the Daf Yomi. So you can follow the Daf Yomi on the phone call. Like, you know how like used to be like the clock, you could call a number and it would tell you what time it is. So similar, but with the Daf Yomi.
Yeah.
And I've called it many times in my life, in times where I didn't have the page in front of me. I didn't have the masechet. I was doing something. I was somewhere, you know, and yeah.
So you don't miss a day. So meaning like you might miss a day and then like catch up. You don't do that. You actually never miss
no.
a day.
I've had days where I couldn't finish the page for one reason or another. Yeah, right. I'm not perfect. But I've opened a book in one form or another, right? And this is so much easier now with smartphones, of course, right? I've opened the book
right,
one
course,
day or another
yeah.
every day.
And what is it about that ritual for you that like keeps you, like you do it?
Learning, growing, and reflecting, right? So I try to live my life according to this idea of tshuva. That is, right, there's a line in Tractate Shabbat in Talmud, 153, I think, right? Rabbi Eliezer says a person should do tshuva, shuv yom echad lifnei moto, a person to do tshuva the day before he dies. The students, of course, say to him, like, but do you know which day you'll die? I mean, right? Like, and of course, he would say, because, like, in my head is, like, some, like, Ashkenazic rabbi, which he wasn't, right? So, like, aha! Like, right, that's, like, right? And said to him, like, no, you don't. And that's why you have to live every day in tshuva. What does that mean? Tshuva means three things in Hebrew, right? It means repent, which is what most people think about, right? The sort of, like, right, Yom Kippur.
Right. Yom Kippur.
Mea culpa.
Yeah.
You know, ashamnu, bagadnu, and so forth. Fine. But it also means an answer, as in an answer to a question, right? She'ela in
right.
tshuva. And the root of the word tshuva also is related to lashuv, to go back, to come back, to return to a higher self, to return to a place of equanimity, to return to a time you felt the most yourself, so forth and so on. So if I distill those three things, right, and the repent thing, I expand a little bit because I think it's much bigger than that. Tshuva becomes three things.
Mm-hmm.
Reflect, respond, return. So every day, right, because we're talking questions, right, I ask myself, right, how to reflect on myself, my world, what I want, what I don't want, so forth and so on. A response as opposed to reaction, right, which we can talk about, right, because response is by far more deliberate than a reaction, right? And that's, I think, where spirituality lives, in that space between reaction and response. And then return, because that helps me to return to a higher self. That helps me to achieve a state where I remember myself being better, growing things.
Mm-hmm.
So the ritual of Talmud, right, being about questions and answers, being about reflection, because I've learned it before sometimes, and the ability to return, to remind myself of both where I come from and where I want to go, that's what the ritual gives me.
I wonder, for me, being someone that, I love Talmud a lot as well, but it's also with a lot of baggage on like a lot of different levels for me. But I think for many people will feel connected to this particular one baggage, which is, being an outsider of like the normative voice within the Talmud, right? It being an inherently, patriarchal text. Of course, like it was written, it was like discussed forever, right? And it was codified, what, in 500? Yeah. Is that like around, right? So we're talking about like an old text, right? Which of course means right. That's what it's going to be, right? And I could do all of the gymnastics of that in my brain, but emotionally in my like heart, when I feel, deeply connected to my tradition, my spiritual tradition, my wisdom tradition, I feel connected to my ancestors. I feel connected to actually the art and the act of studying in this way, meaning what you were talking about before, or just with that analysis and those questions and those digging deep, like that process feels inherent to who I am as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really, really challenging for me when I first started learning it more regularly, because I was like, ugh, am I even in this? Is this even for me? Can I even do this? And, I have different moments where I can answer it differently and I can insert myself differently into it. Sometimes it's like, it's not for you right now. You know what's for you? Poetry. You know what's for you is the, there's times when I do that. And then there's other times where I'm like, no, I'm going straight to the heart of it. I tend to, you might like this, I don't know, or not. I tend to often, I find myself when I'm wanting to return to Talmud, I go straight to Sota. Sota, for those that don't know, right, is like the tractate that holds a lot of the stuff that you don't want to read regarding patriarchy, the stuff you don't want to read.
It's one of the worst,
right? It's one of the worst ways
they treated women. Correct. Very, very explicitly.
Yeah, totally. True. It's like, that's where I go, because I want to not only like find myself within the text, but actually I want to find the redeemable qualities within it. Like, because there are those moments and those people and those stories.
Right.
And
it's like spiritual cutting.
It's spiritual cutting. Totally.
You want to feel something.
Like, instead
you want to feel the
going,
anger, you want to feel something, right? You want to, yeah.
I want to feel that adrenaline and anger, because I actually feel like that's my way in. If I'm being honest, as an outsider, for me, it's not like, oh, I love that story. For me, it's like, what did they just say? Let me see what that is, and let me be in conversation, because that's the whole point of Talmud, right? Is like you're engaging with it. And so it's just really interesting, like, because for you, I imagine, I know, I'm sure you might feel, maybe tell me, like, how do you feel when you're reading? Do you feel like outsideredness when you're reading it, or do you feel like, no, I'm part of this locker room.
I'm one of them.
Yeah.
And they say this with great, so like self-reflection of privilege. I totally, right. That's a very interesting take on it. Right. I can offer one more, which is sort of like sometimes where I like, right. One of the reasons, going back to Torah, not Talmud, right. There's these sort of Midrashian questions of why does the second letter is the beginning of Bereshit? Right, but like, why is it not an aleph? Like, why bet? Right? Great question.
Good question.
One of the midrashic things that I love a lot is that, and I wish that, like, I could show it to people, but like, if you look at a Torah anywhere in the world, every single Torah, and you look at the letter Pei, in the letter Pei, there's a little sort of like superfluous little piece of, right, so like drawing ink that creates the negative space of the letter Bet. Because Bet comes from the Pei, which means the mouth of God.
Bet comes from the mouth of God. Okay.
Like got the it. Arrow yeah. in the FedEx, sort of like, right? Once mm-hmm. you see it, yeah. you can't unsee it. Yeah, if you go to FedEx logo, go to FedEx logo, look at the space between the FedEx and you'll see there's a negative space, arrow. And you're like, wow. And it's brilliant, 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 brilliant. And it's won multiple awards and blah, 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 all that. Same thing with the Pei and the Bet. But it makes me and others, right? So like many commentators, especially in the Middle Ages, to think about that the Torah is not just the black on the parchment, it is the white behind it.
Yeah, the white space. Yeah.
The white space behind it. I say this in relation to Talmud is because it's easy to see these men as these sort of exemplars of the things that sort of that are visible and as the only thing that Talmud offers. But they have wives and they have daughters and they have sisters and they have aunts and aunties. And everything they know, how to love, how to take care, how to argue, how to talk, comes from there. Their voice is not heard because, like we said, it's 2,500 years ago. But their voice is there.
For sure.
And part of the uncovering it is through these words. And some women, by the way, of course, do appear in Talmud by name. Because they,
for sure. Right,
because they're, but the majority of it is a color, a voice that the 2,000 years old, they're not trying to take away women's voices, I think, but they're just like, it's not part of their norm. But the women's voices are behind there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I also think it's quite revolutionary that there are women named. And also even not that they're named, like just even that they're even talking about women's issues, right, no. within it. Even
they
if it's like
to.
Put, right.
Like I said,
right.
they have to because they deal they with their to. Daughters and right. their wives, right?
Right. They're creating a framework for the entire right. collective
they're
society
aware of the
to
women
live
there.
By.
They know that they need them.
Right. Women are part of it. Right. They're, and I always teach it to be very clear with that context, you know, because it's so important. The context is like everything to it. And I think... Before rabbinical school, I didn't feel this way really when I would just pick up Talmud just for fun. But rabbinical school created like this hierarchy of some kind that like just added to the layers that were really challenging, right? Like
absolutely.
That there's a system.
And there is.
That
and, there is.
Be...
and there is erasure of women and women voices. Absolutely. I don't want to take away from that in any way, shape, or form, right? I wish there were more women voices than them, right? And all that. And there's erasure of other things as well, right? There's sort of like, right, we're reading this week in the Daf Yomi, we were reading about the incapability of people that we know are capable, but like, right, for them, people who were like, right, what they considered imbeciles or people who were have different sort of like abilities. And they take them away as people that have less value. I get that, right? I'm not trying to offer apologetics for Talmud. I just for me, I think it's just very important to again to see the white space with the black space and vice versa. And I think that sort of that when you do that, again, you face yourself, right? I have to ask myself, how do I feel about right the Torah I've been taught by people who I don't always name or what I have learned from my daughter, what I have learned from, right, from things. And look, as a queer gay man myself, right, so like part of that as well.
Yeah.
Of how to make sure that on one hand I can see myself in the text, but also how I don't particularly want to read myself into the text, right? I don't want to.
Right.
I don't want to not contend with the fact that sort of, yes, 2,500 years ago, life was very different.
No, and I really relate to that because it's not like I want to read the text. And I'm like, oh, look, the maidservant. Like, yeah, that's yeah. me. Like, that, right. first of all, that's not me. And second of all, also like, no, you know, but I do think there's the beauty of studying Talmud or any really ancient text, but this is what we're talking about. If one is a little bit on the outside, the beauty is I think that I do see that maidservant maybe a little bit more quickly than maybe someone else, or maybe not. But I do think that that's a vantage point that, like, I think is really important. And to be very clear, my anger is just that, like, I feel very connected to these rabbis. I love them so much. And I'm like, hey, let me in. You know, it's from that place. It's not from, because I realize as we're talking, I'm like, people don't know my relationship. You know my relationship to Talmud. People don't know. And I want people to know, like, this tension is from, like, deep love. And I think that that's what Judaism is, right? Isn't it? It's like what it is. Like, you have to, like, I'm not going to engage with it if I didn't love it.
Every person who's been in a relationship, any relationship, long-term, short-term, right, marriage, partnership, whatever, knows that there is two polarities in relationship. One is, oh my God, I love you so much, I can't live without you. And the other one is, get the F out of my sight, right? Like, I don't want to hear your breathing here, right?
Right.
Like, leave me alone.
Like, please don't eat those snacks in front of me.
Right? Or just, can you just be somewhere else? Right? Every relationship is that. And I think that's true for my relationship with Torah, with God, with Talmud, with
anything
my
worth,
like,
it.
Anything that is in relationship is that, right? That sometimes you feel super close and sometimes you're like, I really need to be away from me. And because of that, right, I think we get to be real, right? Because we both get to be vulnerable about where we are. We get to sort of like understand where we are in relation to somebody else, right? And we're able to sort of then choose our actions around it.
Yes, but for you, you never went away from Talmud. And you've, to be clear—
No, but there are definitely days I'm like, F this and F you. Yeah.
Yes, but you still stick to it. Yeah. And what's really interesting is, like, you could have left it a million times.
Yeah, I could have left it a million times.
You've left. You left. You left your ultra-Orthodoxy.
It's funny. I can't even explain how I can't.
You literally left.
I literally,
you completely left. People don't know that.
Yeah.
You also, you were traveling. You were learning with the, when you were learning with the Dalai Lama, were you also doing a Daf Yomi too during that time? So it's interesting, right? Like, you've really, when you were in the army, I'm giving, like, little sprinkles of Iggy's bio that's not there, right?
So what people, so within the Orthodox world, what people don't know, right? People think of Talmud as, like, really book thick books, and it's true that you can care, but almost all of the Talmud is also printed on like cheap paper, like draft print. And these, they're little kuntrasses, right? It's called the kuntras, which is like this gray thing, and you can sort of take it with you. And say, also because my first set has so many notes on it, like, it's really hard to see anything, right? And then, so, at some point you're like, okay, I just spent thousands of dollars on this book. Maybe I should not write in it, right? So yes, so you carry it with you all throughout. And you know, and this is where my own privilege is. Like, some of it I remember by heart. So some of it I don't. If I really know that there is zero chance that I'll see it, right, I'll memorize some of the pages to come so that I can go through them. I plan for when the time that I don't do this, because for me, again, it's like medicine, right? You wouldn't travel without your medicine.
It's your medicine. It's your workout, right? Like, for some people, it's like they cannot miss their workout.
It is my workout. Like, it explains why my body shape is the way it is.
You're like, it's my mental workout.
But I'm like, Iggy, I think you're confusing it for your workout altogether, which explains, but like, okay.
That's funny. And you do it by yourself, except when you teach, right?
Correct.
You're not, because a lot of people in Talmud study do what we call chavruta, right? Like, partnership learning, right? Like, it's a big part of, like, learning, right?
So I have a chavruta, right? I also have chavrutas, right? And some of my chavrutas I've had for a very long time. We don't study Talmud. I have one chavruta that I've had for a very, very long time. He's, well, I know, yeshiva friend of mine who we still study with.
You do?
We don't study the Daf Yomi, but yes, but we still study Talmud together.
Via phone, via Zoom, via person?
Yeah, via phone, Zoom, FaceTime, whatever. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, he's one of the few friends that I've retained from back in the day, that the fact that I'm a far left wing liberal sort of like gay tattooed rabbi has still not managed to convince him that I have no worth.
He's bringing you back just one day at a time.
We've just studied together for so long that sort of that, you know, that I think sort of, right, the shorthand that we have is so deep that sort of that anything else would sort of like, look, the cynical part of me will say like that the relationship is so long that sort of like changing it would just require a lot of, hardship and strife. So we just stick with it. But on the more charitable side, no, look, we have studied for a long, long time. And when you study with somebody for a long time, you know them. And the chavruta, right, as in our tradition, chavruta or mituta, right? So chavruta or death is part of our values.
It is, yeah. So that's why I was always curious with your learning. It's hard to find also that like partnership of learning. It's like it's almost like marriage. I mean, it's right. Such an intense relationship to find the right partner. I'm just sharing it with people, right? Like the right mix. And it's not obvious what the right mix, the right cocktail will be, right? It's not like, oh, you think this way and you think this way, and so you should learn together. Or you both really see the world this way, you should learn together. Or you're total opposites and you should learn together. There's not a necessary, like there's not a formula, you know, that really.
Right. And more than that, when you do it well with somebody, you learn how to deal with your conflict, how to deal with disagreement, how to deal with feeling small, how to deal with feeling big, how to be charitable, how to not be charitable, all these things. If we take it a little meta, one of the reasons I teach Talmud, you know, twice a week and have been teaching this particular class for 11 years is because I highly believe in the ability of Talmud and learning in general. For me, Talmud, but as an antidote to a lot of what's going on in the world, which is sort of this epidemic of loneliness. Right? So the feeling of disconnect, the feeling of no self-worth, the feeling of not mattering, right? I think can be helped by growth. Mm-hmm. It can also be helped by people, right? Engaging with somebody else in their lives or around in a kind of learning, right? This chavruta or mituta is in fact a Jewish response to this feeling of disconnect.
Right.
Because you get to see them, they get to see you, you get to see yourself through their eyes and vice versa. And that is such a valuable lesson that so many people don't have in their lives. And when people ask me, what can we do? I'm like, this is what we can do, right? I often think about, right, everything that's going on in the world and everything. And so like, I'm, you know, thinking like, people ask me, what should we do? What can one do and stuff, whatever. And I think to myself, he's not my favorite character, but like, what would Rabbi Akiva say?
He's not your favorite character?
He's not me. Not at all. What would Rabbi Akiva say? Hmm. And I think for me, right, the answer, if I presume to think like him, would be study.
Right.
Shut up and work.
Right.
Like sort of like, right.
Get to
like,
it.
Right. Get, yeah. Right. Like do the things that you can do on a daily basis, right? How does your daily basis, right? Do you study? Do you meditate? Do you reflect? Do you repent? Do you respond instead of react? Do you, right? Like what are you doing to return to a higher self for yourself and the world? I can't change you, right? I can very barely change myself, but I can, and this is the thing that sort of really out of all the things, right? If I could distill the bio to one or two words, it would be like, Iggy believes in practicing one's sovereignty, right? That's what it is for me. Your actions, your sovereignty is the most important thing that you can gift to yourself when you think about how to make your life better.
And Talmud does that for you.
For me, the Talmud is that tool and that reflection. Yeah, I think so. I also think for everyone. But fair enough. I'm willing to accept that some people are like, that doesn't talk to me. Fine. Sure. Why not?
No, but I think there's something here in terms of like, you know, regardless of one's religion or background or whatever, there is something towards a daily ritual that is steeped in something that is beyond just your daily ritual. There is something to you, Iggy, your ritual of daily reading of Daf Yomi that is actually not really about you at all.
No.
I mean, it is. But
it's been there before me. It's going to be after me.
Exactly. That there's something about that through line in particular that I think is quite wise and really important for our time. And so the question is, what is like another version of that for people, right? And like, insert for you, listener, like, what is that version? Maybe it is poetry a day and learning it. Maybe it's like, I just learn every day, you know, for 10 minutes and it's going through some really beautiful philosophy, you know, like it's like going beyond the, like, I don't know, the scrolling of the phone on TikTok, right? And it's like consciously creating ritual right. around it.
And look, in our tradition, there is an answer to that, which is, right, what is the smallest Lego block of Talmud Torah, right? What is the smallest Lego block that sort of like checks the box of like, okay, I've now have, right, because we are basically, quote unquote, commanded to study Torah every day. What is the minimum amount of Torah I say, right? And there's an answer to that, right? And our tradition says, Shnayim Mikra V'Chatagum, right? You study the Parsha, right? The Torah, right? So like this right. divided into all this. You study the Parsha or the verses twice. You read them twice, just as a narrative. And V'Chatagum, and one translation. In this particular case, is the translation of Unkelus into Aramaic. Fine. But for us, right, Shtayim Mikra, which is just the text, and then maybe an English translation or something else or whatever it is for you, that's it. Because again, right, connecting to some kind of cycle, of ritual, connecting to something that connects you to who you are, right? In our case, as Jews, as Torah and Talmud, whatever. But yes, it could be poetry. It could be whatever it is, right? The ability to suspend your own will of like, I rather go have ice cream, but I'm going to study, right? I rather snooze 10 more minutes, but I'm going to get up and study or meditate, whatever it is. That sovereignty, that action taking, right, is at the core of this thing. And if you add the Jewish value of chavruta to do it with somebody else, that's it. That's a win. And that's a significant win.
Right.
And I've seen it change people's lives.
Yeah.
You know, again, I've had students in this Tamil class and, okay, I'm willing to accept I'm a good teacher. Fine. But some of it is beyond me. We have people from all over the world, Jews, non-Jews, you know, sort of like every gender, every creed, every, you know, people all over now tune in for 11 years.
Amazing. When is it? Do you want to tell people about it or you don't want
to? No, it's Wednesdays and Fridays. It's on Zoom. It's free. It's at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. California. And people are welcome. And you can come to one. You can come to all of them. You can drop in. You can, right? It's like there's no, and we have all levels. We have people who just started. And we have people who've studied with me for 11 years. And we have people who've studied way beyond me, right? There's people who are way older than I am who study Talmud. But I think for me, the charge would be like, find something to study.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's definitely your tour in the world. And I think it's important. It's important to our in the world, especially today, where people are really trying to figure it out. And sometimes just having the text, whatever the text is the way, because it's like telling you not what you have to believe or have to think, but it's something outside of you that can like have some wisdom for your life and then to insert yourself in. And it's so brilliant. And it's funny to me that your rituals as a child is likely, because my last question is usually, what's the ritual that contains you today? It sounds like maybe the same.
It's the same one. I mean, look, I love that. Rituals, right? I have tons of rituals, right? Again, I wake up in the morning every day at the same time. I meditate for 40 minutes, right? I sort of like have Talmud. I do yoga twice a week, right? So like there's a lot of sort of ritualistic things that have infiltrated into my life. Not the least of which, some of just the religious things as a person, right? Who does Kiddush on Friday night and Havdalah on Saturday, like, you know, stuff like that. I think that the question that I would constantly ask when people in terms of study, okay, what do I do? Is I would say like, what are you going to do about it? What actions are you going to take to better yourself?
Right.
No matter what thing it is that you are, and I don't want to say this judgmentally, complaining about the thing that sort of that irks you or pains you or whatever it is. Okay. And, right? I mean, part of spiritual counseling, as you know very well, right? And sort of the majority, right, of my work is looking forward. Okay, I understand where we were before. I understand what we've gone through. I understand the past, right? Narrative, trauma, whatever you want to sort of like engage in, which is really, really important. But for me, what is more important is how's that going to look like tomorrow? And that's up to you. The ritual is only as significant as the commitment you're going to have for engaging with it again. And I think people sometimes have trouble with that because again, we're back where we started. I think people think like, no, but I like the choice, what I want to do today, whatever. And so like, fine, but that's not freedom. Freedom is the ability to know what you're going to commit to.
And it's hard. It's harder for more people than I think for you, it might be more natural potentially, Maybe it wasn't always, but it at this always, point.
That's the thing. I mean, the truth is no. I mean, right? I mean, yes, now it's a routine that I've had for, right? Mm-hmm. But there's still plenty days that I'm like, ugh, right? Sort of like, I have too much to do or things. And it's not that I really ask like, oh, am I going to skip today? But the question is like, where am I going to fit it? Or what am I going to do with it? Or, right? So one of the amazing things about this thing is sort of that, right? Because I've studied it now about 7 times, sort of, right? But there are pages that you study that are harder to understand than others. And there are pages where I'm like, I can't just glide through. And I'm like, what? Like, I know I got this 6 years ago, right? I've moved on. What am I missing this time, right? Because we change all the time.
Right.
So there are days I'm like, want to be like, I'll deal with it later. And sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, but right? Because I don't want to make it seem the sort of that it's easy just because I've done it, right?
When I said easy, I guess it's the wrong word. What I meant was actually like, that you're just committed to it and you're doing correct. It.
Yes.
So, and that question mark that many people might have is not a question for you, at least at this point. Yeah, at some point it was, but like it is, right? Like this is again, happening. Commit,
and what are you going to do about it? So you're committed. Okay. Right. It's like people like, oh, I heard Oprah say like, you know, my religion is love. And I'm like, and? How does that look like, right? What are the actions you take for that, right? So a commitment is great only as far as the actions that you're willing to engage on a consistent basis with it. And it's not about discipline and it's not about grit. It's about making meaning. The actions we take, the ritual thing, is about making meaning, not about the prize of it. Right? Is what does it mean to you? How can it make your life better? And not because you're going to exercise or lose the weight or study thing or get the degree, whatever it is, but what are you going to learn about yourself? What is the question that this is responding to in your own self? And I think why people do feel disconnected is because not only do they not ask the question, they're not taking part of their own answers.
Right.
And they can. It's just a matter of deciding. In the West, we often say like, oh, don't sweat the small stuff. And I'm like, no, it's the opposite. Just focus on the small stuff. The big stuff will take care of itself.
Right. Right? It's the everyday action.
It's the everyday. I ask clients all the time, like, describe to me your perfect day. Not a perfect vacation day, but like a perfect regular day. And really go down to the details. When do you wake up? You know, is the bed by yourself? Is there somebody else there?
Right.
Right. Is do you snooze? How many times do you choose to snooze? Right. Do you open the window? Do you see a city? Do you see a river? Do you see a creek? Right. So like, you know, do you mind driving or not? Right. Are you sitting in a cubicle or not? Do you work in a team or not? Right. These constant things, because those are the majority of our days. And if you ask those questions, you can also like, actually, you know, yeah, you're paying me all this money to do this thing, but I have to get in the car and I hate it, then blah, you know? So those questions of you and the action, right, become so much more important about finding the answers of what will make you find meaning in your life.
Yeah. And creating moments to ask those questions, super important.
Yeah. And that happens with rituals.
Rituals.
Right? Rituals. Rituals
it's
create
true.
The canvas, right?
They
the
do.
Canvas, right? Which it's rituals like, create the
that's
canvas.
That's where it is.
And so like, oh, how was there yesterday? How am I there today?
Yeah. If I had my druthers, I would say like, listen, therapy has its moments and there's important times for it. But like, if you've gone to your therapist for the last, like, let's just say like 2 years and you're wanting a shift, let's shift it.
100%. I could not agree more. I feel that many people who've come to me, whether when I worked at rehab or in general now, have had therapy for many, many years.
Yeah, same. A lot of people. Yeah.
And fine. But spiritual counseling is much more about, again, like about tomorrow, about the future, and changing people's lives with actual questions and homework and work that you're supposed to do rather than just like reflect. Now, some therapies are much more engaging, right? I don't want to disparage any kind, right? Whatever works for you.
I'm a big fan.
Right. But for me, It's okay, and what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, for sure. It's that. And for me, the ritual component is like, I led a ritual recently and there were like three people that were crying. And it is not, by the way, because I am so amazing at facilitating space. I'm great. Yes. I know I am. But there was also just this like grief that they were holding that they didn't realize was there. And the ritual allowed for them to sort of open up to it and release.
The ritual creates a space for us to feel contained in.
Right.
Right. And it allows us to engage more than one person, or sometimes just one person, as a way to feel that it's the ultimate un-gaslighting of yourself.
Right. It's good. Yeah.
It's the ultimate place where you get to really feel where you are, understand why you're there, feel the feels, right? Have the emotions, but also then decide vis-a-vis action on where is this in your life? Is this going to be again tomorrow, next month, next day, right? It allows you a consistent check-in that creates a space for you where you really get to respond rather than react.
Right.
That's where spirituality lies, we said before, right? Because right, the reaction is always like, oh, I'm sad, I'll do this. Or I feel triggered, I'll go for the drink. I'll open the fridge for the 16th time thinking perhaps some miracle piece of cake just appeared there, right? But those are because we don't like ask ourselves, what am I really feeling?
Right.
Right? And if we do that, if I can ask myself, what am I really feeling? Then I get to sort of like, oh, I'm actually anxious and nervous. Yes, this sort of piece of cake is not going to solve that. So the ritual allows me to sort of create more spaces where like, oh, I have to respond rather than react.
Right. And I'll just share for me, the ritual I do most days, I'm not going to say every day, but I would say most days is writing for me. It's the journal, like it's the physical action, because then I am aware of my feelings. When I do not write it, it's like, oh, I don't even read it. It's just, it's out of me. And I'm like, oh, that's why I was so snappy at my husband yesterday. Oh, it's that thing. And I don't get that through talking personally. And there's something about that.
For you, it's writing, but right, you can journal, right, with voice recording.
Totally.
You can journal with drawing, right? There's totally different ways
I tell people to draw all the time.
Absolutely.
Get it out. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I have sort of this sort of sheets that sort of I came up with, right? So like of journaling and what that looks like. And there's also the rituals of prayer in it. Again, as you say, the ritual of reflecting.
Yeah.
Right. Again, is living a kind of tshuva, right? Sort of like, how do you reflect, right? I have this one of the rituals. So I cannot go to bed unless I've seen a bloom that day.
A bloom meaning like a flower.
Something that's bloomed. Yes. I have to find my daily bloom. It's one of those things that I do and I've done for a long time. It's much easier in summer and spring, granted, especially when you live in a city, right? It's a little harder in winter, but it is possible. And it's because it's about that awareness of finding something, of reflecting, of finding something, right? Of curiosity, right? Those values that sort of allow us to do this. And it's kept me in a very interesting space, right? For somebody who wants to sort of journal like that, if you will, where I have to, that means that I have to go outside, right?
Yeah.
Right. It usually can't be a flower in my vase, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, get flowers in your vase. It has to be kind of like right in the ground or something. It forces me to go outside. It forces me to look for something. It forces me to find beauty. It forces me to remind myself that sort of nature continues, even though sometimes I think this sort of like the world is ending because it's all about me. Right. So again, as a ritual, it allows me to journal where I am vis-a-vis what I need to do that day. I encourage people always to do something like that, to find something like that.
The question I ask my kids often at pickup is, because they're at a school where there's like a lot of nature, I'm like, is there anything that like you saw today that was like particularly stunning nature-wise? It's a weird question, right? But I do think I just want to build in their psyche that like no matter kind of, even if they're not at a beautiful nature school, no matter where they are, like you are part of something.
No, totally.
Right? Like there's just this thing. And it's taken me a while to figure out the question for after school. Before it was like, how was your day? It's never going to work. Like, who'd you play with? Who cares? I don't care who they play with. I really don't care. I don't care what they care, you know?
No, for sure. I mean, yeah. And it can be something, right? I'm pretty dark, right? I think people say like, right, there's like skulls everywhere. Like, right. There's a great Instagram thing that's called Nature is Metal.
Mm.
Do you know it?
Mm-mm.
But Nature is Metal.
And that's very you.
And it's basically like, right, sort of like from the lion chasing the gazelle to the alligator eating, like, right? And it's gruesome sometimes, right?
Not for me. Yeah.
But yeah, it's not for you. But like, but for me, it's like, oh yeah. I mean, there's beauty in that, right?
Oh,
there's,
totally.
For me, like, right? So yes, for some kids, like, oh, I saw a daffodil today. And some, like, right, maybe even your kids will be like, I saw a dead pigeon and I poked it with a stick, right? Sort of like,
oh yeah. Yes. One of my kids is like, I saw the hawk with the mouse.
That's right. That's
in
right.
The beak and all the insides. And I'm like,
that's right.
Beautiful,
right.
Amazing,
exactly. And it's stunning,
amazing,
right? Something like amazing. So yes, I think part of what is amazing you do with your kids, you and I think with adults sometimes we have to help get some help with this, is like to train ourselves to sort of see things and look for things,
patternings,
and questions. One of the things I love about Judaism, of course, and I think a lot of people don't know, but there's a blessing for everything.
Fiddler, right? On the roof, Fiddler on the roof. That scene. What's right. The blessing for the sewing machine or for
right? But right, there's a blessing machine. There's a blessing when you see a spider web. There's a blessing when you see, right, so like the rainbow. There's a blessing for the first rain. There's a blessing when you see a tree in bloom. There's a blessing when you see a tree that should be in bloom and is not in bloom. There's a blessing when you see the ocean for the first time. There's a blessing when you see 10,000 people, right? Yeah. There's a blessing, like, right? There's a blessing when you see an ugly person, and there's a blessing when you see a beautiful person. There's a blessing when you see a rabbi, right? Like these constant things. And again, right, there's way too soon. It's like, oh, this is so OCD, right?
We have OCD in us.
Look, I mean, 2,500 years of inbreeding produces great genius, but also great OCD and anxiety, right? Don't come at me. I know it's a joke, you guys. But like, right, sort of like, but I think the sort of that part of this sort of training, right, of the mind to seek, to look, to find, right, to engage with, to observe, right, is part of this sort of Jewish tradition. Again, that keeps us connected.
Yeah.
Right? It keeps us connected to the external world, to us, right? When I see a bloom every day, I'm both delighted and relieved.
Still here.
I'm still here. This is still here, right? Like, this looks, you know, this looks beautiful. This is a little harder. It's now winter, right? Like, oh, yeah. Look, it's daffodil time. Oh, look, it must be spring because this is like, oh, it must be the last of fall because now this is springing up, right? So like it constantly engages you and also sort of nature in general, but yeah.
Okay. Iggy, we can talk all day, obviously. So we're gonna have to end, but yeah. I love you. Thank you for being here showcasing. Please share with people where they can find you so they can make sure to look you up.
Sure. So the easiest way is to find me on Instagram. Again, not your rabbi, one word. That's where you can find me. You can find me online as well, sort of, you know, different things. And people who want to come and join Talmud, they most certainly can. There again, on the Instagram, there's a link there to sort of find the Zoom sort of invitation and all that. Yeah, this has been great. I mean, again, we can talk all day. So I'm happy and delighted to always talk to you.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. He really is such a great thought partner for me, and I'm glad you got to sort of hear his way and hear our way of learning together. So rituals for this week. There's a lot happening, like astrologically speaking, which I didn't talk about in the beginning, but there's the eclipse season. So I'm just going to recommend a ritual of like releasing patterns that no longer serve us and let it be eclipsed. So I recommend sort of saying a mantra every day of, I am releasing the patterns that no longer serve me and I am letting them be eclipsed. Eclipses are beautiful opportunities to sort of really release things that just no longer like work. Yes, you can do that on everyday life too, but I think there's something like very wise about working with what is existing in the universe, in the collective. So that energy is here. So like, why not work with it? So that's one thing I'll recommend. The second thing I'm going to recommend is actually what we talked about on this episode, which is try to figure out a daily practice that you can do. And I know Iggy does everything every day, but I'm going to actually say, do it 5 days a week. 5 days a week instead of seven. That can mean the weekdays or it can mean 5 days. 5 days out of the week, I want you to try this week. And yes, you can pick up Talmud if you'd like. You can pick up Torah, Tanakh, some religious Jewish book if you'd like. Or if you're like new to this practice, pick a book or a poetry or a book that's like something that you normally wouldn't just read before bed. Something that makes you think a little bit and have to like revisit a line. Maybe it's a philosopher that you loved in college. Maybe it's a book that you read in high school, like The Odyssey, that you've always wanted to read again, but you feel like you can't just read it, you know, on your own. You kind of need to build the time to build the intellectual pursuit of reading it. And I invite you to do that daily, to have a daily practice. You can make it timed, if that's easier, of 20 minutes of just studying. Create a space for yourself to say, this is my time. This is my spiritual practice. This is my ritual of study. I think something happens when we do something regularly, when we do something daily or 5 days a week. Something can really occur within us. And I think that using our minds, which is exactly what Talmud does, it requires us to use our minds in analytical ways, in ways that opens our hearts and in ways that breaks our hearts. Find something like that that you can have as yours and try that for 1 week and see what happens. Thanks for being here. Please, if you love the show as much as I love the show, send it to a friend, recommend it, keep listening. We have more things happening. We have some really great offerings in April in person, the Ritual House. Follow along on this journey. So, so glad to have you. Thank you for listening to the Ritual House podcast. Please be sure to follow the show on whichever platform you are listening to this right now so that you'll never miss an episode. And as we grow the show, we want to hear about the rituals that are meaningful to you. We invite you to share your ritual practices with us. You can DM us at theritual.house on Instagram or find us on our website, www.theritual.house. Also, as a new show, your feedback is really important to us. Please head on over to Apple Podcasts and write us a review. And if you enjoyed this episode, why not share it with a friend? We'll see you back here next week to continue the ritual revolution. In the meantime, I'm wishing you a week filled with intention and attention. Take good care.